Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Conversations from the Diaspora, a Building Africa's Future podcast. And as usual, I'm your host, your sister, and your friend, Nkiru. And in today's episode, I'm joined by a very special guest. I'm joined by Mr. Curtis Reynolds, an international affairs consultant focused on international development and security issues. He has worked with the United Nations in a variety of capacities during his service from 1985 to 2016, when he retired as the Secretary of the UN Secretary General's Advisory Board on Disarmament Matters. So thank you so much for joining us again today, sir. And I would like to just once again start by expressing my appreciation to you for always being available to speak to me whenever I had any questions regarding the UN or any other type of international kind of affairs related matter. And I appreciate you for always like sharing your insight as it relates to this topic on hand, on navigating the international space. And one thing that I've observed, and I know that this has been documented as well, is that as it relates to representation in the field of development, foreign aid, or global international affairs generally, you don't often see our people, Black people, people of the African diaspora, despite the fact that so many of these international programs and services, in one way or the other, policies are targeted towards our populations, whether it's in the Caribbean, whether it's on the continental Africa, in the US or wherever else. And even when it comes to study abroad, I know from my personal experience, when I traveled to China and when I traveled to the Dominican Republic for educational tourism purposes and service learning programs respectively, the people there seemed somewhat taken aback at seeing me, but seemed more welcoming, accepting, and familiarized, I guess, with the white travelers that I came with. I think they were like surprised to see me. Maybe they were used to seeing, you know, like as I mentioned, maybe more white travelers, people who are in this kind of international field. And I wanted to know if you could speak to why that is and what do you think can be done to change these perceptions and bring in more diversity into these spaces, especially with leadership and policy making.
Okay, the way I would answer that is as follows. First of all, your experience with the study abroad is somewhat a different issue to the one you find yourself in with regard to the international or national aid agencies. For example, in the United States, it's run by the government of the United States, and naturally the people who work for those organizations kind of reflect a reflection of the society in terms of their bias in terms of who has the leadership positions within the organizations. If you look at it at the multilateral level with the United Nations or the IMF, you get a more diverse staff, but at various levels. However, the leadership roles will tend to be held by people who are nationals of the major donor countries who actually provide the international aid. You mentioned that our people, I assume you're talking about Black people, are usually the target of these of the aid agencies in terms of they are the donors and we are the recipients. It's sort of obvious why that is. The countries with the wealth who are in a position to donate and to provide assistance are usually North American or European countries. So it's quite natural that you'd find the citizens of those countries holding leadership positions. Now, in the United States, it's a little bit different because they have a history of the presence of Black people, or also maybe the UK, United Kingdom. There you would expect to find, one would expect to find more people of color. But the fact that you don't see so many is usually a reflection of the racial narrative or the state of race relations within those countries. Now, with regard to your experience in study abroad, first of all, when it comes to tourism, you'll find more people from North America, the Europeans and some of the richer Arab countries, in the Middle East. They're the ones who can really afford to tourism. So it's not surprising to me that people in the host countries, in the service industry, they would show some kind of bias, whether it's negative or whatever, to seeing a black person. For example, I'm from St. Lucia in the Caribbean, and I remember in the 70s, the 80s, it would be very rare to see an African-American. We get most of our tourists from Canada, United Kingdom, United States. So it's very rare for you to see African-American or black tourists. So when you, even for me, when you see them, it's a bit of an oddity, not in a negative sense, and you take a second look. And I'm pretty certain the experience would be different to that of a white person, even in a predominantly black country like St. Lucia. For example, I joined the UN in 1985, so I used to come to St. Lucia on home leave once every 2 years to visit back home. And I would sometimes go to the hotels in the tourist areas. And you would find that you get treatment which is slightly less favorable than that which is accorded to a white person from North America or Europe. Sometimes my friends would joke and say, no, that's a slave mentality. We would laugh it off like that. But things have changed over the years, and now in 2020, it's much different. I think it's because the people in the service industry, they have gotten much better training. So you find they treat you very well. I mean, they actually tell you, welcome home. How are you doing? What's it like? And they're more engaging. I remember in the 1980s, they would they come around the tables and ask people what they want. And then when they expect that you are, they call you local, and they expect you to go up to the bar to order your drinks rather than having someone come to you. So it's kind of that sort of reaction is sort of reversed in the Caribbean. But like I said, it's, and even not only St. Lucia, but other Caribbean islands, things have changed quite a lot in the past 20 years. I think due to enhanced training in the tourists and the entertainment industry.
Now, I'm actually happy that you mentioned that, you know, this type of change is happening all over the world. I think one of the most important things is having exposure, having conversations, and kind of making yourself, I guess, more showing that your presence is there, like making sure that we're present in these different types of spaces. So, you know, as we've mentioned, you've definitely had extensive experience working at the United Nations for over 30 years, which you shared in your presentation at Howard University titled Blacks at the United Nations, which is part of what prompted my conversation with you on my platform. So, because I wanted to ask you, from the time that you started at the UN until you retired, and even now as an observer and as a consultant, what are some of the challenges that you and maybe some of your other Black colleagues that you were close to experienced while working at the UN body and other international organizations? And how have things changed over the years as the UN celebrates 75 years?
Well, as you would have seen from the comments made by the 20 very senior staff members of the United Nations, the UN had its own internal problems with regard to the question of race. But I would like to more frame them in the context of the difference between people who come from the developed world, like North America and Europe, and those who come from the developing world, like myself and you. I think that when when people first join the UN, from whatever country they come from, everyone comes from their 190 different nation states into the UN, and they bring with them a lot of baggage, all the biases, cultural and other biases, they bring them along with them. Now, the thing about the UN is that the people who work for the UN are a little bit more sophisticated than the average person on the street. But it doesn't mean that they are not different, you know. It is often said that no matter what color you are or what country you are, everyone's DNA is 98% the same. So I would say that when a new staff member is recruited into the UN, they more or less bring their cultural biases, but like I said, they're a little bit more sophisticated, better educated than the average person. So they are very adept. At least after a couple of years experience, they become very adept at hiding their biases, but it comes out all the time. But the way I like to look, I like to look at it from the lens of economic power. Generally speaking, the people who tend to have the most senior jobs in the United Nations would tend to be from, again, I hope I'm not sounding like a broken record, but they come from North America, United States, Canada, Europe, with a sprinkling of a few people from the developing countries. That's not to say that the experience of the black person, black staff member of the UN is all bad or negative. I like to tell young people that one should not focus too much on the experiences of individual black people within the UN. You come in and you do the best you can, and you do your job. One thing you need to do is make sure that you promote yourself, because no one's going to promote you, and you have to look out for yourself. And also, the black people who join the United Nations, they, especially when they get to the senior levels, they need to take care of their up-and-coming young people. What you find happening is that the people from the most favored nation states, they take care of their people. So we need to take more care of our own people. And that's what I would say about that. But it's usually more, I would say, maybe there's a bit of risk involved. I mean, the UN consists of thousands and thousands of staff. I would be naive to think that you don't find racist. I've worked with people who are perfectly fine, and I've worked with people who I think are perfectly racist, but they're pretty good at hiding. Yeah, but the UN doesn't stand for that. It's not something institutionalized. I think people just bring in their own conscious and subconscious biases into the organization.
Now, Mr. Reynolds, you mentioned something very powerful, and this is something that I, you know, really appreciate that you've personally done, making sure that you help others who maybe have similar experiences with you, maybe culturally and otherwise. And one of the reasons why I appreciate you for even coming on my platform today is, you know, when I reached out to you, you openly kind of received me, you responded in a very kind way. You gave me some really good information, and I really thank you for doing that. We need more people like you who have worked in these different fields and who have the experience and can share with those who are coming up. So once again, thank you so much. And I'm going to kind of touch on that point a little bit later, but can you walk us through what your typical day was as a political affairs officer in the Office of Disarmament Affairs, and what recommendations, if any, can you offer to the UN and other international bodies as it relates to, you know, this issue that we've been kind of talking about often throughout these past few years of representation, policies, or any other thing that you can think of to effect positive change?
Well, I assume you are asking me that question in the context of race and culture. Well, first of all, as a political affairs officer in the Office for Disarmament Affairs, you're just like anybody else. You do the same job. As a political affairs officer, you do a lot of research. You prepare papers for the head of the department when they're having discussions on various disarmament issues with various countries, either at the bilateral or the multilateral level. That's a job that everyone does. In terms of race, it's more or less just the same as working in any other part of the UN, whether it's the United Nations Development Programme or UNICEF or UNESCO, IMF, World Bank. they're pretty much the same in terms of the race issue. For example, in disarmament, the most important weapons would be nuclear weapons, and you know that they're held by about nine countries in the world, five of them within the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're called the P5. They're all Europeans and North Americans. So obviously, if you are a nuclear weapons possessor state, you have a lot of clout. And in the field of disarmament, you find that, again, like any other part of the UN, certain countries have a lot more influence than others when it comes to the weapons like chemical weapons, of course, nuclear weapons. When it comes to small arms and light weapons, that's where the African states and other underdeveloped states come into play. Because a lot of the small arms and light weapons that are produced in the world by the major arms producers, they go to fuel armed conflict, political conflict in Africa, Asia, and other parts of the developing world. So from that perspective, it's not the race based, it's just that's the way it is. The darker skinned people come from the poorer countries. They are the ones who are exploited by the developed world. So, but coming back to your original question about a typical day in the life of a political affairs officer in the Office for Disarmament Affairs, it's the same whether you are Russian, French, Argentinian, St. Lucian, Barbadian. Your day is the same. The same is expected of you. The only difference comes in is the end reward sometimes.
Okay, thank you. So as we all know, staying at home, this year has been very challenging in many ways, from the coronavirus pandemic to the social pandemics of longstanding societal ills like systemic racism and police brutality. The murder of George Floyd really shook the world in a powerful way that led to so many protests in cities around the world, despite sheltering in place and other social distancing guidelines. There have also been lots of good to come out of this year, such as increased discussions and heightened sensitivity and attention to the necessity of diversity and inclusion. You know, we see lots of different companies like incorporating this diversity and inclusion segment into their policies, into their hiring, into their discussions and everything. And it was also nice to see that over 20 senior UN agency leaders of African descent spoke out against these issues, calling for the UN to step up and speak out against oppression. Do you think this will be a lasting change, and what will it take to make it sustainable?
Well, I think that the non-white states, the African states, it's not sustainable if I think that the 20 senior staff members of the UN were very brave. They are acknowledging something that we all knew all along, but when you are a young person joining the United Nations and you are of color, you're a black person, it's one of the first things you learn, and your black mentors tell you that, is that if whatever happens, try not to blame it on race, because you're not going to get very far in the UN if you do. The general trend of thought seems to be that, well, racism doesn't really exist in the UN. Like I said, it's not institutionalized. It's not supposed to happen. There are rules against it. But like I said earlier on, people bring in their bad habits. Some of them have it very entrenched in their own countries, and they haven't done much about it. At least the United States tries to do something about it from time to time. I think that it's something that is underlying in some of those societies And it takes certain despotic leaders like we have seen in the recent past to dig it all up again. So with the election of the new president of the United States, I would expect things to get better slowly, but it's never going to be be ever eliminated, but completely, but we should bring it to the stage where no one dares to implement any racist policies or racist behavior. So in the UN too, I think it is it's a very good thing that the 20 senior staff members of the UN were brave enough to do it. It's something that I couldn't have done at my level. But there was certainly in a position to do it. If you get 20 very senior people at the assistant secretary general level, the secretary general can't fire all of them. Yeah, so I think it's a good thing, but the member states of the UN, at least those of us who have natural interest in race relations, they need to be very vigilant and call the UN up and all the other organizations up, call the senior staff up every single time they slip up. It was a good first move. I don't think they can do it again, but the member states, especially those of the Africa, Caribbean, and other nations of color, they need to keep the pressure on 24/7 on the UN and the other organizations.
Yeah, thank you for that response. Just to switch gears a little bit, from my own experience and, you know, from our discussions, I've been offered several internship positions at the UN, but none of the regular full-time staff positions, which again, I would say speaks to the issue of maybe excluding certain demographics who cannot afford to commute to the UN office daily in an expensive place like New York City, for example, especially given that the UN internships are, for the most part, or at least to my knowledge, I think they're completely unpaid and they don't offer a living stipend. And that, even with the internship, it doesn't guarantee or even increase your chances of landing a job at the UN once you're done, I guess from what I've heard. So what advice would you give to young professionals who would like to get their foot in the door of the international arena in the areas of diplomacy, public policy, or otherwise? And what would you say for those who are already in the field? Like, what are the best practices of navigating, you know, getting into the system or being in the system and moving up?
Well, first of all, for those who are aspiring to get into the system, you shouldn't be discouraged. One of the ways to get into the UN is get some kind of exposure to the kind of work the UN does. So certainly doing an internship, if you can afford it, is one good way. My son did a couple of internships in the United Nations in his career. But he was able to do it because I work for the UN and we lived in New York. So it's just a matter of a bus trip. What you find is that when people from the African continent and even some parts of this Asia, it comes down to a question of money. Not many people in Africa can afford to put up their sons and daughters or students from the universities, put them up in New York for anywhere between 2 to 6 months. Very few people can afford that. Most of the black people I know who have served in the UN as interns actually lived in the United States. Many people from the African countries have problems getting a visa in the first place, a U.S. visa to come across to New York. But I am pretty certain that you get African interns serving at the African at the Economic Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. I'm sure there are quite a few. But again, Ethiopia is in East Africa, and I'm sure it's quite a financial pull for someone from South Africa, Nigeria, or Ghana to go across even to Addis Ababa. It probably would certainly be more cost effective, but it all boils down to a question of money. For example, the French, the Americans, the Canadians, Germans, apart from the fact that their parents and family members are often financially well endowed, they also can get scholarships from various universities and foundations to finance their stay in New York or in any other United Nations duty station. So again, without sounding like a broken record, it comes down to economics.
Very powerful point, and I think that's something that the UN really needs to take into consideration, because I know there are countless students who have the desire and possibly would make great candidates if they were given opportunity to, you know, have some type of living stipend or just something, not just, you know, kind of free labor, but that's a different conversation. And but you've answered this question at different points in your responses, but I want to address it in a different way. So among some of my classmates and peers, and even in my coursework in school, the following question would come up from time to time. Do we need a United Nations in today's world? And in what ways would you change the UN system if you feel it isn't operating in the best way that it should? And part of the reason why I'm asking that is because a good friend of mine who came to this country as a refugee from Sudan, he feels that the UN has failed his country, Sudan and South Sudan, and other African countries. So what could you say to that, both to his experience as a refugee and kind of seeing maybe some of the efforts of the UN peacekeeping and how he feels, you know, things went wrong? And I guess to the question as well is, do we need a UN in today's world? And if so, or if not, what ways should it be changed?
Well, my answer to that question is, despite the flaws in the UN system, you definitely need that organization. I think the world would be worse off if we didn't have the United Nations. The United Nations has done a lot of good in its own way. And you need the lens, the multilateral lens, being focused on certain conflicts to bring about some form of resolution. And I think that's where an organization like the United Nations comes into play. I think the United Nations plays a very important role. One of the things about the UN that a lot of people don't understand is the fact that the UN is made up, we talk about United Nations, it sounds like one person or one body, and it operates in unison and operates consistently at all times. And the problem is the United Nations consists of 193 member states. Each one of them has its own political, economic, and social agenda. All 93 agendas don't necessarily operate at the same time, but you find there are different regional agendas, often competing at odds with each other. And that's whenever the UN fails to do its job, it's usually because of the divisions between the various and the differences in the agendas of the different groups. Well, now, one of the most memorable examples of the UN failing would be the case of Rwanda in the mid-1990s. Kofi Annan, in his autobiography, spoke about his anguish when he approached, actually personally telephoned the representatives of about 100 member states of the UN to get help in Rwanda, and none of them came up to help. A few of them only came up with a couple of hundred peacekeeping forces, but just enough to take care of their own nationals within Rwanda, but not to take not to protect the people of Rwanda from the genocide that was going on. So I would say that whenever the United Nations fails, it's usually because of the failure to have a consensus on particular issues. I mean, I spent the last 12 years of my career in the UN in disarmament, and in the area of nuclear disarmament, the situation is close to being in a shambles. There's no agreement on the elimination of nuclear weapons. About 4 years ago, I think it was, there was a treaty which was established to prohibit the use of nuclear weapons. What you found happening was that all of the states who possess nuclear weapons refused to sign, become members of that treaty. Plus, a dozen or so of their allies joined with them. But at least you have at least 126 to 129 member states of the UN who have signed up. So at least there's some sort of moral suasion or moral persuasion on the part of the non-nuclear weapon possessor states, in the sense that they kind of put some pressure on the nuclear weapon states. But there is never any genuine move towards disarmament in nuclear weapons. During Kofi Annan's during his tenure as Secretary General, he once said that in frustration that the world is moving from mutually assured destruction to mutually assured, I think it was apathy, so something close approximation to that in terms of what's happening in disarmament. Like I said, when you look at the situation closely, it always comes down to competing national interests and a lack of confidence between the member states. A lot of the conflict you have in the world results from a lack of confidence. So you often hear about, in the field of nuclear disarmament and other forms of disarmament, you heard talk about confidence building measures. You see, the thing is, you can never ask another country or another group involved in a conflict to lay down their arms unless they're confident that the other side will also lay down their arms. Okay, it's something even at the individual level. If two people have are in an argument and you know that each one has a gun, you can't persuade only one of them to put down the gun unless he is assured, or he or she is assured, that the antagonist will also put down their weapons. It's a lot to do with competing interests and lack of confidence in each other. That's why I think it's very important to have the UN and to do everything possible to uphold the multilateral diplomatic system.
Okay, thank you so much for that. And before we round up, we've talked at length about your professional work, and I just wanted to switch gears just a little bit to talk about you personally as an individual. As you know, my podcast is geared towards the African diaspora experience. So one thing that I always like to ask my guests, particularly, is about their cultural identity, background, and upbringing. And I know you're from St. Lucia, as you mentioned earlier, which is in the Caribbean. And I'm actually not too familiar with St. Lucia. So could you tell us, for the viewers and our listeners, how was life growing up there? Did you always see yourself getting into the international field? How did you get your start? And what were some of the cultural differences that you encountered when you first got to the U.S. as it relates to, you know, what we've been discussing the entire evening on race relations and even your encounters with other members of the diaspora, and how did you overcome some of these challenges, if you don't mind sharing a little bit about that?
Well, okay, I come from St. Lucia in the Caribbean. We were colonized by both the European countries, the United Kingdom and France. They fought over us for hundreds of years. We were 14 times British and also 14 times French. Sometime in 1821, I think it was, the British finally won over St. Lucia. We remained a British colony until 1979, when we gained our independence. The population is, I would say, about 90% black. You have white people who are fifth generation white people. In St. Lucia, we like to call them the local whites. By this time, they're not 100% white, but they enjoy a very privileged position in society. Actually, I was born in the United Kingdom because my dad went to law school there. And so I first came to St. Lucia in 1967 from the United Kingdom. And 1967, St. Lucia was still under colonialism. So I remember seeing on certain days like the Queen's Birthday or Commonwealth Day, British Commonwealth Day, you'd find there would be ceremonies where the British Governor General, a white guy, would drive down the street in his fancy car, going to the center of the city, where you have, for example, on our equivalent of Memorial Day, where you celebrate the veterans, the Governor General would come down, I think it was on the 1st of November, and lay a wreath at the monument for the fallen veterans, both black and white, at the memorial in the center of the Derek Walcott Square. Actually, we used to call it Columbus Square after Christopher Columbus, but a couple of years after we get independence, we now call it after Sir Derek Walcott. He was the second St. Lucian to win the Nobel Prize. He won the Nobel Prize in 1992 for literature. So coming back to the colonial issue, St. Lucia became an independent state in 1979. So we took over the reins of government, and I was recruited as a young diplomat. So it's always been a source of pride for me to represent my country at the UN. But it's a very small country and a very small diplomatic service. So after 5 years, I had the opportunity to join the UN, where I could sort of spread my wings and explore greater opportunities. Now, on joining the UN, as I mentioned before, when you join the UN from a developing country at an almost entry-level professional job, it's pretty tough moving up the ranks. I think I did a good run. It could have been better, but I'm reasonably satisfied with the progress that I made. Some of my black colleagues didn't do as well as I did. There are a couple who did better than I did, but it's a career that one should think about. And I like to tell young people, do not be discouraged. Even when I tell them stories about the UN, I tell them the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I tell them don't let the ugly and the bad deter them. A lot also depends on how you play your cards, whatever organization you join. But I must admit that there is, when a young person joins the UN, if you are from Europe, North America, you have you have an edge. I remember one of my friends from the Middle East, he said, you know, when you come from a small country, from day one, they give you a 10% discount, you know? So you have to fight to reach zero and then move from zero upwards. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Once again, thank you for joining us and for taking this time. It's truly been an honor having you on. And just as we round up, could you offer, I know you just gave some words of encouragement, but is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners? Maybe what you're doing now currently, or just any type of encouragement you would like to give them? And if possible, if they would like to reach you, could you share anything?
Well, first of all, any young person, a millennial or from what age group who needs some advice on moving ahead in a career in international affairs, feel free to contact me through my LinkedIn profile. I entertain questions all the time. It's more or less come a retirement hobby for me to answer the questions of young people. So feel free to contact me on any one of my social media. The most obvious ones would be LinkedIn. I'm also on Twitter and also on Facebook, but I'm more most of the time on LinkedIn. So if you have any questions, you can pose them to me right there. We can arrange to have a chat by Zoom if it's convenient, and give you the heads up on making a career in the international field. And thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.